Colleague.
Thank you. Yeah. Tonight's a bit different from our usual sort of just Bible studies or reading books of the Bible. It's an Israel special, and that's going to occur in three ways. I'm going to talk, first of all, as you can see, because I've already managed to put it up there, about San Remo, which you may or may not know much about. And then in the middle, we're going to have a chance to for people to share about any trips they've made to Israel, and in particular one recently by my friend Chris Fosters, who's joined us tonight. So she'll be talking about that. And then I imagine there'll be a bit of time left towards the end for me to talk about something else. But I'll leave you to think, well, I'll tease you about that till we get there. So I'm going to talk about San Remo. And as you can see, I've already put up that this year is the centenary of the actual original conference. And everyone was looking forward to lots of celebrations about this particular centenary, big events planned, particularly in London and indeed over there in San Remo. And of course, everything's been cancelled. And I think, therefore, it's important still to mention it and explain it so that people know the significance of what otherwise is just going to slip by. And a lot of you will be very familiar with something like the Balfour Declaration and the centenaries that happened then about 3 years ago. And this is the next important thing to talk about. So this is what I put together, mainly to start with, because I wanted to know more about it. And the first thing I wanted to know about San Remo is where it was. So there it is on a map of Italy. And you can understand that's why people can't go at the moment, can't go anywhere really. But it's there on the Italian Riviera, right next to the border with France. So next to Monaco. And if I give you another map, you can focus in on it and see that it's just round that particular bend from Genoa and down towards Nice. In other words, it's a lovely spot, usually. And the conference took place there in a conference took place there in a villa called the Castello d'Evesham, on a hillside looking down onto the Italian Riviera. So that's where San Remo is. Maybe worth a trip eventually sometime when we can all travel again, see what it's really like down there. It's obviously a small place, but very nice. When did this conference actually take place? Well, obviously I've told you 100 years ago, but more specifically, from April the 19th to the 26th. It actually opened on the 18th. Like all these big international gatherings, I'm sure they got together the day before and had a wonderful dinner together. And probably on the 26th, they just had a nice big lunch together. But basically, it was a week long. And it was to discuss, in particular, the future of Palestine, as it was then. And this particular issue came up right at the end of the conference on April the 24th. And the 25th, the last 2 days of the conference, were set aside to discuss the future of Palestine. Interesting that on April the 24th and the 25th, we'll also be having a conference. And it might be worth, during the course of that conference, me doing another short session on this, perhaps doing a workshop or something. It just came to me today. I haven't discussed this with anyone yet, but it could be one of the workshops that we do on those dates while we're doing our own conference. So that's when it was. And the conference was chaired, not surprisingly, by the Italian Prime Minister, called Nitti. And these last 2 days, very hectic days, were to consider the future of Palestine. So who was there and why was all this ordained? Well, after the First World War, the newly formed League of Nations had to decide the future of the Middle East, particularly in the light of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire had expanded greatly, and it included a whole swathe of territory, including what we think of as the Middle East. The Ottoman Empire decided, in the end, to side with Germany in the war. So they came out on the losing side, and therefore their fate was going to be decided by others, certainly in terms of their ex-territorial possessions. In other words, what lay outside their main region, outside what's called Anatolia. So all their territorial possessions were now going to be decided separately. They weren't allowed to keep them. Various other meetings and treaties have been taking place since the end of the First World War. So the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, which came into force in January 1920, set out the very complex terms of peace in a settlement with Germany. So that was to do with Europe. But the Middle East remained as an important issue. And it was discussed at a London conference in February of 1920. And then another conference was arranged at San Remo to complete the work of the earlier conferences to sort of tidy up this final bit. So it was an international gathering of the four main Allied supreme powers that had won the war. Those were Britain, France, Italy, and Japan. The United States were also allowed to be present with observer status. So the American ambassador to Italy was also there, but purely as an observer. On the British side, there was the Prime Minister, Lloyd George, with his Foreign Minister, Lord Curzon, and one or two other officials. France had their president, who was called Alexandre Millerand, and an assistant foreign minister. Italy had, of course, their premier, Francesco Nitti, and another high-up official. And Japan's ambassador, Kashiro Matsui, was also a major player there. So they were the four particular powers, with the United States, let's say, as an observer. Now, the United States had had a previous input into all this because the president, Woodrow Wilson, had come up with a 14-point sort of decree, really, that the four Allied powers, the victorious Allies, were not allowed to acquire for themselves new colonies in the Middle East. Okay, there was no sense that, oh, we've won, so we can go and grab these areas for ourselves. So the constraints that were put upon us was that new sovereign states would be established in the Middle East over a period of time. But not all areas of the Middle East were yet ready for full independence because they'd been under Turkish rule for a long time, and it wasn't right just to sort of set them free. They weren't ready for their own full independence yet. So the idea of mandates was agreed, with the Allied powers in charge of implementing each of these mandates. Prior to meeting at San Remo, various delegations, both Jews and Arabs, had met in Paris in 1919 and made their submissions. And in fact, other submissions were put into the pot, if you like, since then, which made a very complex set of proposals that were being considered. And the point of the San Remo conference was to turn these into final binding international laws. And that's the crucial thing about this. San Remo produced final binding international laws. And in particular, over the mandates for Lebanon and Syria, which were under the jurisdiction of France, and Mesopotamia, now known as Iraq, and Palestine, which were under the British rule or supervision. Now, the first three of these, Lebanon, Syria, and Mesopotamia, were able to govern themselves very quickly with assistance from the mandatory power involved. But Palestine was a very different case because it had been declared through the Balfour Declaration to become a homeland for the Jewish people, but the vast majority of Jewish people weren't there, and this was quite a new concept, and it was going to take a lot more time to put that into place. So the mandate for Palestine was completely different from the others, and the idea under the British jurisdiction was to set out how the land was to be settled there by the Jews before they could form a viable nation themselves. So the first important point is that the agreements made at San Remo became international law and are still valid today. And that's the reason why people are making such a big deal of all this, because you might think that's 100 years ago and things have changed and so on, but actually nothing has changed in terms of legal rights. And just to sort of jump ahead a little bit, after the League of Nations, the United Nations came into play after the Second World War. But as part of the Charter for the United Nations, and in particular Article 80, the United Nations were not allowed to change any legal rights that had already been made by the League of Nations. They had to just take them over and keep them the same. I'll come back to that point later because it is rather important. But it does mean that San Remo, for the first time in history, Palestine became not just a geographical area, but a legal entity. And sovereignty over Palestine was then vested in the Jewish people, just that they weren't yet there ready to take full control of it. Now, the Arabs were given equivalent rights and sovereignty in Lebanon, Syria, and Mesopotamia. So they already had those equivalent rights in these other places through these other mandates. So to do with Palestine, there was no provisions made there to satisfy any Arab national aspirations, nor indeed did they want them, because they had these elsewhere. And as we'll see a little later on with one or two more maps, that mandate included east and west of the Jordan. Now, it's important to note that the official name for this territory, for the Jewish national homeland, was Palestine. Therefore, the original Palestinians were Jewish. The word Palestinian, originally, at that time, referred to Jewish people. That's why their orchestra was called the Palestinian Orchestra, maybe Palestinian Symphony Orchestra or Philharmonic or something, and their newspaper was the Palestinian Post. Only later did it become the Jerusalem Post. It wasn't until, obviously, 1948 when a nation state was set up and called Israel that the term Palestinian sort of fell into lack of use, if you like. It was no longer used by the Jews because they were now Israel and therefore Israelis. And so that term became sort of just sort of left on the shelf for a while, and it was later picked up in the 1960s, particularly by Arafat, and he's recreated a new people with that name, as distinct from Jewish people. Very clever ploy on his part, really, to pick up something that had once been used by the Jews and sort of abandoned once they become Israel. So, but originally, whenever I talk about Palestine or Palestinians at this time, the 1920s, we are talking about Jewish people. Every single nation in the League of Nations, that's about 50 or 51 of them, voted in favour of the San Remo Agreement. There was no problem there, it was unanimous. And any additional nations that later joined the League of Nations also signed up to it. And as part of this San Remo agreement, the Balfour Declaration was recognised and incorporated into international law. Up to that point, it had just been a declaration of intent. Remember some of the wording of it? It was that the British government looks with favour upon the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish people in this land and so on. At that point, it was just an intention. But at San Remo, the Balfour Declaration was incorporated into international law. And that means all prior agreements that had gone on before then were then terminated in favour of the Balfour one. So if you're familiar with some of these things, like the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916 and so on, they were no longer relevant because the Balfour Declaration became law. So, because of what happened at San Remo, it means that the transfer of the legal title on Palestine cannot be revoked by either the League of Nations or its successor, the United Nations. And therefore, the Jewish state, even today, draws its legal existence from San Remo. And no later UN resolution or partition plan or anything can possibly override that. The San Remo Agreement was incorporated into the Treaty of Sèvres, which was signed by the Ottomans in 1920 and then approved by the League of Nations in 1922, and also officially signed and included in the slightly later Treaty of Lausanne, which was started in 1923 and ratified in 1924. Now, not being a total expert on this, I've tried to get my head around the fact that then the Treaty of Sèvres actually was never fully implemented. It was sort of aborted because at this time someone came on the scene you might have heard of called Kemal Ataturk. And he was the one who was going to rebuild the Turkish nation. He became the sort of the father of the modern Turkish nation. And he forced the Treaty of Sèvres to be scrapped as a treaty. But the individual elements of it remained as binding international law. So that didn't in any way diminish the San Remo resolution. And anyway, Sèvres was later replaced by Lausanne. Now, the tricky matter of boundaries was actually discussed on the second of these 2 days, in which they talked about Palestine, April the 25th, in particular. And you may have seen some of these pictures before, but the original British mandate for Palestine looks like the one on the top left in white, which was quite a huge swathe of land. It took a lot of discussion on this, and a lot of people like Lloyd George kept saying, well, biblically it's from Dan to Beersheba, and that became a sort of common phrase for it. But that didn't mean that it started at Dan and went up to, or the way around, started at Beersheba and went up to Dan. It just was an encompassing biblical term. But that was the original mandated land. But you can see that what happened is that part of it, the yellow bit, eventually was cut off from that. And the Brits did that. But that was something they were allowed to do because part of their mandate. One of the articles in the mandate, Article 25, gave Britain permission to postpone or withhold the terms of the mandate in the area that was on the east of the Jordan. And in September 1922, they decided to do this. And this was approved by the League of Nations. And this created a second mandate, a new mandate for what was called Transjordan. And in fact, that territory was referred to as the Transjordan Province of Palestine. Interesting, it was still known as part of Palestine, but it was a separate Transjordan province. As far as I can tell, there was no issue with Britain being able to do that. It was part of the mandate that they were given that that territory on the east of the Jordan could be separated off. Now, in 1946, that area eventually gained independence from Britain and became what we now know as Jordan, or the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. So there was that modification to it. But the other important point to go with this is that the remainder on the west side of the Jordan River, which includes what's now known as the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and all the rest of it, remained part of the San Remo Agreement. Original one as part of Palestine for the Jewish people as a homeland. And as I've already said, the United Nations inherited, had to, by their charter, all these agreements that have been made. Any rights given to a people prior to the United Nations coming into play must be honoured, observed, and protected. And although in 1947 Britain terminated its stewardship of the mandate, and actually officially notified the United Nations of this, that in itself does not terminate the mandate. It's only Britain's stewardship of it. So the actual terms and conditions, the legality of it, remained in place. And even though the United Nations then proposed a partition plan and had a famous resolution called 181, those were only recommendations. And the interesting thing about that, this new partition plan that the United Nations came up with, is that although the Jewish leadership accepted it, the Arab leadership rejected it. And once one party had rejected it, it has to end. In other words, that it remains just a proposal. It never can become law. So whenever you hear about anything to do with the United Nations doing a partition plan and all the rest of it, that did not come into play legally, simply because the Arabs at that point rejected it. So when the State of Israel was formed in 1948 and then recognized by the United Nations, the only internationally legal binding law to do with all this was on the basis of San Remo. And nothing that happened since then, any wars of independence, Six-Day War, whatever, could make any particular difference. So that means that when you hear this well-known phrase, illegally occupied territory, you have to realize that in a lot of sense, it doesn't really make sense. It's totally inapplicable to talk about Israel's presence, say, in the West Bank as illegally occupying a territory, because you can't illegally occupy a territory that actually still belongs to you in the first place. The only time that an illegally occupied territory, that phrase can be used, would be actually if there are Arab or Palestinian settlements in that same area, which is still legally Jewish areas. But nobody ever thinks to use that phrase within that context. Although I've seen, a newspaper article about it. I don't mean a major sort of daily newspaper. I just mean a sort of Christian newspaper explaining all that. Anyway, that's what I've learned and understood about San Remo, why it's important, why the centenary was going to be celebrated, and why I think people should know about it, because it really ought to deal with any confusion or misleading information that gets put out about some of these things. Now, at this point, I would love to answer lots of questions, but I've come to the end of my expertise on this. However, people can ask questions, and maybe other people know more than I do and want to add something to it. So do you want to unmute people now so that anybody can chip in with that, either to tell me that, yes, I knew all that, but it was fascinating nonetheless, or I didn't know that at all, or why didn't I know this, or whatever. Anyone got any comments?
Paul, I've got a question. Can you hear me?
Yes, just need to know who it is.
That is Christine.
Oh, okay, yeah, hi.
Hi.
Sorry, Christine, there's a lot of background howl coming through. Can we take a question from somebody else?
No, is there still a problem?
Yes, we can't.
One second.
Christine could write it in the in the comment in the chat.
Is that better now?
Yes, I think so. Try again then.
Okay. So Paul, I've been hearing this from the liberal lefty side of the what they're saying. The most common criticism is that they're saying, what gives the European powers the right to carve out the boundaries like that?
Originally, because they won the war. But it was the Allied powers that won the war. So the Ottoman Empire had to be dispersed.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, under the international agreements, mandates were put in place. And therefore, they didn't but they were allowed to oversee them becoming mature, independent countries, which of course they largely did. the Palestine, as in the Jewish Palestine, would take a bit longer to do.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, just simply because the basis of it was because they won the war from...
Well, let's put it the other way around. It's because the Ottoman Empire, which had grabbed these lands in the first place,
yep.
lost the war by siding with Germany, and therefore they were to lose these extra territories that they've been claiming. So it was a matter of what should we do with them, hence all these international conferences.
Right.
In the same sort of way that something happened in Europe to work out what was going to happen within the territorial lands within Europe. And particularly France and Britain were given mandated powers, which is like just sort of a supervision towards full sovereignty elsewhere. And that's why you get Lebanon and Syria and Iraq today.
Just simply because they won the war. Okay. Thanks.
I'd rather put it the way around. It's because the Ottoman Empire lost the war, and therefore they had to lose the territories that they had grabbed. They were still allowed to keep their own territory of Anatolia, which eventually became Turkey as we know it today, which is when, I said, Kemal Atatürk rose to power and re-established Turkey as a nation. Just to say, if you really want to read a bit more about this, there's a wonderful book. I think, can you read the title of it?
Wow, yeah, okay.
The Initial Foundation of International Law.
Wow.
It's 700 pages. I haven't read it all, I just dipped into it. If you want a smaller 10-page read, then this is CFI's booklet. And don't be confused by its 90 years on, because they wrote it 10 years ago.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
But that's a much shorter idea of getting
it. So the summary of the book.
Yes. Any other questions or comments upon that?
Yes, John and Jan.
Yeah. Paul, from what you said, it implied that the area which is now known as Jordan was part originally of Palestine.
Yes.
And as such was part of Jewish territory.
Well, it was part of the territory that was set apart to become a Jewish homeland.
Right.
But so I don't think there were many...
changed.
I don't think there were many Jews that had already gone there
necessarily
interested in it. And as part of the mandate, Britain was allowed to divide it into these two. It's always said, oh, we gave away 78% of the Jewish homeland. Fine. We could be criticised for doing that, but there's nothing illegal about that. And I don't think at the time there was too much fuss in that it became just a different province of Palestine. It just later, in 1946, then became a new country, which becomes Jordan, we know. Okay?
Yeah, so the Jewish nation no longer have any valid claim in law to that area.
The current... I don't think so. That would be my understanding of it, but because... I see what you're saying, though.
But Britain gave it away as part of the mandate, as you said, and that became part of the law.
Because
I've looked at this before, so technically we gave it away, and that became legally binding, as far as I'm aware.
Yes, I would think that. The crucial point which comes out of all this is that what's now called the West Bank and Gaza Strip and those other bits of the left-hand side, the 22%, technically, legally, under international law, remain part of the Jewish homeland.
Always has been.
Yes.
And Jordan still is, legally.
But we know that the way that history has developed from the 1960s onwards, for instance, people have now said, oh, that should be split up and belongs to the new Palestinian group, which Arafat set up. Any other comments or questions on this?
I'd like to make a point, and that is that under King David, there was a much greater extent of land belonging to Israel.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that every modern land division has to go by the Davidic borders, but they were considerably more, quite a lot of the land from in the north from Mount Hermon, way down into Saudi Arabia, was at that time in Jewish control, under Jewish kingship.
Yes, or Israelites, anyway, yes. But of course, they lost that land when they went into exile, so that changed things from that point of view. So we're really, and I know what you're saying, but that doesn't come into play when you look at the more modern legal situation. Once the Balfour Declaration was put in place, that there would be a Jewish homeland, that's when it sort of kick-starts the next round of where this all goes to.
The other point is that at the time of the years from the mandate forward towards 1947, there were some quite powerful Arab groupings who, under the previous 50 years or so, now needed to be reckoned with, placated, dealt with, conferred with, put in positions of a certain amount of autonomy over a piece of territory. And Britain had a complex job trying to fix the legalities and also do businesses of different kinds with the Arabs sitting on the ground, each of whom had control over a certain number of fighting men. So it was quite a complicated situation on the ground.
And I think that's why they decided to give up the mandate in 1947. And this was getting a bit much.
Well, I think prophecy has a certain amount to do with that as well.
Yeah. Any final comments or questions on the whole San Remo thing, without going into all the rest of the history of all this, but that's why it was going to be celebrated, obviously it is.
John, you've got another question?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Can I also query, what's the current legal status of Gaza? Is that a separate entity now, legally, or is it still legally part of Israel?
It's still part, from what I know, but I can understand, and I haven't plowed through all 700 pages of that book. The original agreement is still in place, it's still valid, and therefore, I mean, if Israel chose to, there's been all these different sort of conferences and treaties, land for peace sort of thing, so they gave them Gaza in order to stop them firing rockets into it, and of course that didn't work. Now, to what extent modern Israel can actually give land over, I don't know, but the original agreement still stands. And therefore, it is part of the original mandate in Palestine.
Right. Yeah, I had heard it said that it was land for peace, and because they've got no peace, then they've invalidated that agreement.
From a moral point of view, perhaps, but I mean, a lot of these so-called treaties and so on just never really held water, did they? So,
Now, I think Marion has a question.
Well, I was just going to comment. When they pulled out of Gaza, they didn't give the land back. They simply withdrew.
Oh, yes, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, okay, good way of putting it, yes. Yes. Right, okay. Now we're going to move on. So in this next section, I'm going to hand over in a moment to Chris Foster, who's joined us, because she's had a recent trip to Israel, which is very interesting and worth hearing about, and Harriet also, who can also join in on this. And then afterwards, as part of this, I was going to open it up to anybody who wanted to say briefly, at any point, recently or sometime in the past, I went to Israel and I had this remarkable experience, or something like that, to share something about it. But let's hear now about this very recent trip that Chris has done. So, Chris, are you ready to take us through the next bit?
I'll just mute everybody else so we haven't got around and open
Thank
you up.
Thank you.
Okay. No.
Hello.
Just a moment, I did that wrong. control. Yes. And then unmute. Okay.
Right. You can hear me, can you? Well, hello. This is my first time of joining you. So thank you, Paul, for inviting me on. And I'm going to share a little bit about a recent trip to Israel, and then I'm going to hand back for comments or whatever. So Harriet Faulkner and I, we've just come back from a trip to Israel with a difference as far as we were concerned. We went as a part of a group of 13 people, all from the UK, to a place called Galilee Worship near Tiberias, run by Arnie and Yonit Klein. Now, Arnie is a Messianic Jew and Yonit is a Gentile, and they were both born in the USA, but called to go and live in Israel in the late 1980s. Interestingly, if you've ever read The Cross and the Switchblade by David Wilkerson, Arnie and Yonit were attending David Wilkerson's church in New York when they heard the calling from God, and they were sent out to Israel by that church. Their calling was to prepare a place in Israel where Yeshua might feel comfortable so that he would have freedom to express whatever was on his heart. Whatever was on his heart. Now, before we went, as preparation for that, we were requested to read some articles written by Arnie, some from his website, Galilee Worship. If you Google it, you'll find it, Galilee Worship. And also this book, which I don't know if you can see, yeah, just put it up there, Israel Revealed, which can be read as a book or can be done as a course. Can you see that, everybody? Let's put it on, held it up like that. Hopefully you can see that. And that can be read as a book or done as a course in a group. And so before I went, I'd read some of this literature. And one of their basic teachings, which became clearer to me, was about the one new man and about this whole thing about being grafted into the olive tree. So it says in Romans 11 that looking at the olive tree, that we Gentiles are wild olives who've been grafted into the olive tree of God's people. And I discovered that in the natural world, in the natural world, in order to make an olive tree more fruitful, some of the cultivated branches are cut out and wild olives are grafted in amongst the branches. Now, those cultivated olives that have been cut out, they're then laid down under the tree in the shade, and they can stay there for up to 3 years. And meanwhile, the wild olives settle in, but the tree is still not very fruitful. Then after 2 or 3 years, once the wild olives are settled in, the cultivated branches can then be picked up, that are lying under the tree, they can be picked up and they can be grafted back in. And they might look completely dead branches, but they can be grafted back into that original tree. And at first, that doesn't make any change at all, and the tree isn't bearing much fruit and there's not much difference. And then suddenly the whole tree starts flourishing as the branches work together, and the tree is loads more fruitful than it has ever been before. Well, that was a complete revelation to me. And so I went having sort of finally understood a lot more about the Gentiles and Israel and the relationship that is so important to have, which I know you all know about anyway. But the whole thing about cultivating the tree and how that works was quite amazing to me. So Arnie makes the point as well that both the wild olive and the cultivated olive are branches sharing together in the nourishing root, which it says in verse 17 of Romans 11, that they're sharing together. It actually says, you being a wild olive tree were grafted in among them and with them became a partaker of the root and fatness of the olive tree. So what actually is the root? The root, the taproot, is God himself. So Arnie and Yonit have already run 40 Galilee worship gatherings, mostly monthly, lasting for about 10 days. And our group was the 41st gathering. So it seemed like a new season to them. And significantly, for the first time ever, all the visitors were from the UK. And it was considered significant that we came as we did straight after Brexit. We arrived on the 20th of February, straight after Brexit had happened, and wedged in just before coronavirus took hold. In fact, the next three monthly gatherings were also all booked up by people from the UK, which was considered really significant, but gathering number 42 has had to be cancelled due to coronavirus. So at the moment, our group that went out are the only group to have gone since Britain left Europe. Anyway, that was considered very, very significant and may have been the reason why things sort of opened up so much. So the way our times worked together while we were there was each morning we would meet and spend a minimum of two hours in worship, Gentiles and Jews together. We were to understand that God doesn't just want us to come to him when we have needs or to tell him what we want him to do. We are to come to him as little children, wanting to get close to his heart, to seek his face and see where he is looking, because God is a person, not a formula. And our aim was just simply to be there and to follow where he led. There was no worship leader, no one actually taking the lead. We formed a rough circle facing one another, and we were to be, quote, alone together with God, unquote. So we were to come together and we would be there talking to God in the first person, using I and you, not using he. We came together as living sacrifices with no requests, no questions, no expectations, just to tell him we loved him, to worship him, as in I love you, and things like that, in the first person, not talking to God as a he, that he wasn't in the room, but assuming that he was in the room with us. We might only sing one known song throughout the whole of that 2 hours. You know, that was, you know, astonishing, really, because you normally get through quite a few songs in 2 hours, but quite often we only sang one known song. There were usually two or three skilled musicians with us and a table absolutely heaped with a variety of instruments that we were free to use, percussion instruments and the like. And at times one person might feel an anointing to sing or play something, and there might be a great crescendo of worship, and at other times there would be complete silence. And it was really powerful. At times in the silence, there seemed to be instruments joining us in the heavenlies. I could hear drums and cymbals sort of just wafting around, which was very, very precious. I think there's only been one time in my life that I've experienced worship quite like that. Our afternoons were free, in which we could digest what had happened and maybe go for a walk. And then in the evenings, we would have a meal and discuss together what the Lord had been showing us earlier in the day. And often Arnie would bring some teaching as things came up in a very Hebraic way, in response to discussion and asking us questions to get us thinking, trying to get us to get to the point ourselves. Very interesting, interactive and Hebraic way of teaching. One of the main things that came out during those times was that the times, the end times, the times are getting really short in the world and the darkness is closing in. And that's probably feeling more evident now than it was a few weeks ago. But it may be that these times that we're living in now are final warnings. We need to prepare to set our houses in order, to repent on behalf of ourselves and our country, to come before God daily in worship and reverence, to seek his face, to get to really know him, to know where he's looking and what he's doing. The story of the wise and foolish virgins in Matthew 25 is a chilling warning. When the virgins with no oil returned, having gone and looked for some oil, when they returned, they found the door shut and they called out, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered, "Truly I say to you, I do not know you." We want to be ones who are prepared with enough oil. So how do we get to know him and how do we put our houses in order? These were issues that were coming up during the time we were there. Firstly, we need to get our foundations right. Now, I know that you guys, you've done a lot of talking about foundations, so maybe you know this, but anyway, I will just sort of say how it came across to us when we were there. Foundations are usually hidden, and the importance of what our foundations are like only becomes apparent when there's a shaking. Like in Matthew 7, with the wise and foolish builders, the houses perhaps looked identical, but it was where the foundations were and what they were like that made the difference to whether the house stood or fell. In Proverbs 3, verse 19, we read about God's building plans and how he built creation. And it says, "The Lord, by wisdom, founded the earth. By understanding, he established the heavens. And by his knowledge, the depths were broken up and clouds dropped down dew." Wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, these three things. In Exodus 31, verses 1 to 3, we read that God, when building his tabernacle, chose Bezalel to design artistic works because he said, "I have filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom, in understanding, and in knowledge." This seems to be God's pattern for growing into maturity, and it doesn't just happen in a day, it takes a while. So then we looked at one way to test our foundations. One way to test our foundations is to consider that Abraham, first and foundationally, knew God as El Shaddai, the all-sufficient one, the many-breasted God. Abraham left his home and family to walk hand in hand with God, knowing and trusting that God would meet his every need while he was gone or after he'd left. So if we have any anxiety about money or provision, we need to walk hand in hand with God and get ourselves more fully rooted in the knowledge that he is the all-sufficient one to us. Of course, there were times when Abraham doubted and went off track, but he was prepared to sacrifice his only son, Isaac, knowing that God would provide the right sacrifice. So that's one thing that we talked about at quite some length while we were there. Later, we see Moses encountering God as Yahweh, "I am that I am. His word is truth." Moses learnt to walk closely with God, and he understood that God is holy and to be obeyed. Now, there's another booklet which I'm just going to put up. And this is another booklet which Arnie has written called Preparing the Way of the Lord. Hope you can see that. Preparing the Way of the Lord. And in that booklet, he says, for many years, gifts and tangible experience have been exalted above character and sacrificial living in much of the church. We have no doubt that this, along with blindness to Israel, has put the church far from God's heart. So we need to be seeking to be responsive and obedient to his word, seeking to build character into our lives. And the last aspect of one of the main bits of teaching that Arnie was bringing to us is the need to know Yeshua and intimately, and that's part of the knowledge. When I was talking about wisdom and understanding and knowledge is a very intimate thing, like a husband and wife know one another, and so we need to get to know Yeshua intimately, seeking his face, giving him time to speak to us, not just coming to him with our requests, giving him time to speak to us, to point us in the right direction, and then responding to his words. So we found our time in Galilee to be absolutely radical and life-changing. But interestingly, so did Arnie and Yonit and their companions, who had also never experienced a time quite like it. We all left there feeling very impacted and feeling that there was a paradigm shift in our lives, in our thinking, and in our relationship with God. Thank you very much. You can.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris.
So, shall I hand back to Paul or somebody? Do people want to make comments or anything? Or share or talk about any trips to Israel they've had?
Can I just ask something?
Yes.
The Galilee Workshop.
Galilee Worship.
Worship. Sorry. That wouldn't have been the Galilee Experience, would it? We went to the Galilee Experience.
Did you?
Yeah, was that the same thing?
Where was it, Marion?
In Galilee.
Near Tiberias?
Yes.
Well, ask, maybe Harriet can answer that question. I wasn't aware that it was, no.
Okay.
No, I don't think I have an answer.
Okay, fair enough.
I don't think it's necessarily the same thing.
Okay.
There is a website, isn't there, that he has. Is it Emmaus Way?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and well, there's a website called Galilee Worship.
As well, yes. There's, probably can't see it on that, but there's some websites. But if you're interested in this booklet, can they get this booklet through the Emmaus Way website, or is it only available out there in Israel?
No, there is a lady who, again, Harriet will tell you, is it Elaine somebody?
Yes. There's a lady, she's in Loughborough, she has stock, and we get in touch with her by email. Her name is Elaine Croft. So she's got stock. I've checked that with her, and we can get hold of that.
How do we get in touch with her?
Well, I suppose I send you her
email address,
her email, or ask. But I wrote to her a few days ago saying, "Have you got the stock?" And she said, "Yes, plenty." And then she spoke about maybe I could drive it to near you, and you could pick it up from near you, because obviously. There is post, there are parcels. I'm not sure how things work this week. Anyway, there wasn't an order made this week, but she's ready for if an order is made. But the thing is, some of her material would be better dealt with, perhaps. It's not wrong to read it on your own, but it's also designed to be read in the company of somebody else. That, again, might be a bit difficult, unless we are all Zoomers.
So okay. just to reiterate, we've got Israel Revealed, which can be read on your own or done as a group thing. And then there's also Preparing the Way of the Lord, which is really just for individual reading and perhaps as a preparation for the Israel Revealed. But this was written after Israel Revealed. Well, I only got this when I was out.
Can I just say, I've been to the Galilee experience in Tiberias a number of times, and it's not the same as what you've been describing, and I don't think it exists anymore.
Oh, okay, thanks. Thank you.
Thanks.
What are my comment on this is that, I mean, I went to Israel 3 times a long time ago, and obviously it impacted me. But this has made me want to go again in a different way. When I went first time, it was as a tourist, getting to know the place a bit. Then I went on a study tour with CMJ, which was great. And then I went with Chris Hill. That was good. And then I've stopped. But what I'm realising is that when I go again, I don't want it to be just another tour or even another study tour. If there's things like this that's out there, which focuses in this case on worship or maybe something else that's different, then that's what I want to go to now. And I'm looking forward to realising once we're free to travel again and life becomes a bit more normal, to seeing just what God is doing there that we can go and join in on. Because this is really amazing. And I don't know if you want to add anything on this, Chris, but you told me about then you moved on to Jerusalem and when you were thinking about David...
Yes.
You realise from what God said to you that it's because David was a true worshipper.
Yes.
That he was of God's own heart, even though in other ways morally he wasn't quite up to it.
Yes.
He was a worshipper, and that counts for everything. So.
Do you want me to share a bit more
please
about
do.
That?
Yes. Go on. Do explain about that. Yeah.
Okay. So on our very last morning. At Galilee Worship, Arnie came over to say goodbye, but somehow he got onto the subject of David. And he said, so what was the difference between David and Solomon? Why did God love David so much more than Solomon? And why did it all work out like that? Because actually, David was an adulterer and a murderer, and you know, things weren't all that great in his family. But the thing that he brought out was that David was a worshipper and he loved God and he wanted to know God's heart. When Solomon came along, God asked him, what would you like? And he said, I'd have wisdom. So God gave him wisdom and riches. But he did say to Solomon, don't multiply to yourself horses or wives. And he actually did both of those things. So he didn't really love God and understand the importance of listening to him and obeying him and being close to him. Whereas David really sought the heart of God and tried to be close to him and know what was on his heart. And so that was the final little bit that I heard of what Arnie was saying. And then we all got in a minibus to drive off to Jerusalem. Some of us were going off to Jerusalem for a couple of days before we came home. Now, I'd never been to Israel before, and I'd never been to Jerusalem. But what I'd felt the Lord had been saying to me before we even left home was, when I go to Mount Zion. And so when we got there to Jerusalem, everybody was saying, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I want to go to Mount Zion. Yeah, but what do you want to see? No, I just want to go to Mount Zion. And I couldn't explain any more than that. And as we went in the Jaffa Gate and we turned right and people were saying, oh, let's go into the Christchurch shop and let's do this and that. And I was going, well, let's do that later. I want to go up to Mount Zion. And I felt really compelled to go. And I sort of ushered everybody up there. And, so then they said, well, do you want to go in the upper room? And I said, well, I don't really know, because I'd never been there. So anyway, a couple of people went in and they came out very quickly and said, oh, it's very churchy. I don't think you'd want to go in there. And I said, well, that's fine. But we could go up onto the roof. So we went up onto the roof and we walked round, and there were some lovely views and I got some nice photos and everything. But I still didn't feel that that was the place I was meant to be going to. And then somebody said, well, how about let's go to David's tomb? So I sort of followed the crowd and we went along to David's tomb. And there comes a point where you have to split off. So there are the men go to the right and the women have to go to the left. So I went round to the left and went down this corridor and turned right. And I realized we'd come into a new little area, but I hadn't even realized that this was where David's tomb actually was, that I'd come to the place. I hadn't realized it before suddenly there was this real strong empowering came down upon me and a sort of a whoosh right through my body. And the Lord sort of almost had to direct my eyes and said, look, this is David's tomb. This is David who I love. And worship is so important. And worshippers are so important. And that's what I really long for, worshippers. And it was so overwhelming that I had to sit down on a bench. And the Lord was just saying, yes, and I really love David. And this really is his tomb. And it's not, you know, somewhere that you just, you know, that might be his tomb. This is really his tomb, and I love him so much because he gave his heart to me and he worshipped me and he loved me. And I was just overwhelmed and I couldn't get up for several minutes. And Harriet and the others were like, oh, where is Chris? What's she doing? But I was just completely overwhelmed because the thing that Arnie had been talking about just was completely reinforced by God when I actually got to David's tomb. He was just sort of just reinforcing it so much, the importance of worship. That do?
Yes, thanks a lot. That's added an extra dimension to what you were sharing before because it ties in with worship, but also with the fact that you're gaining revelation and some of these things can only really come by being out there.
Yeah.
And experiencing it. Your first trip, that was a wonderful blessing and a wonderful gift to you. And certainly it's inspired me to want to go and get more in touch with God out there than just seeking him here. So
it moment, Paul, you've gone muted yourself or something's happened.
I beg your pardon. That reason is because I unmuted myself and then I... Can you unmute me permanently, Nan?
No. You've gone again.
Okay. Don't worry. I wanted to hear from anybody else who has got an experience of a trip to Israel, a time when they were there, any special revelation, whatever. So if anyone wants to share something, now's a good time.
I've been lots of times, sometimes for significant periods of time. But last year, two of my friends went with a Joshua Aaron tour and they were completely transformed by that. It impacted them because it was all worship. Mm. They were worshipping all over the place. Literally all over the place.
Yeah.
And because I've been a number of times, I've been out there for like 6 months, in fact, 9 months, actually. You know, I don't want to do just a tour. But I would quite like to do Joshua Aaron's worship.
Yeah.
There's something about the power of breakthrough in worship. And, yes. And they were, when they were standing at the cave that's, where is it? I can't even remember where it is, but it's, we will not, but and they were singing the songs, we will not bow down to the gods of man. We will worship the God of Israel. And it's the cave where like, Baal gates of hell, where it's that cave, you know. And it's just so powerful. And you can actually, at the moment, on Facebook, they're actually doing 30-minute virtual tours of that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Check out Joshua Aaron. I mean, it's brilliant. And even just watching the virtual tour is quite impacting. But because I've got two very good friends, you know, it just really impacted me as well.
Yes. Has anyone ever been on a prayer tour to Israel, for instance?
Well, I was in a prayer.
Yes, Harriet.
Harriet's been on a prayer tour.
A year ago, I went to Israel, to Jerusalem in January to become part of the prayer conference run every January by Intercessors for Israel. And Intercessors for Israel has a website. They issue a weekly prayer letter. Chuck Cohen is the current leader of the conference and of the weekly prayers. And you are able to go for as many or few days as you can manage, but the conference runs for the first week in a hotel within Jerusalem, and for the second week by optional coach tour, which, because they're so keen about praying for the security of the land, is a matter of visiting every border and some border posts and meeting the IDF, and at every place possible, stopping to have information, then having prayer times before getting back into the coach, or else, where possible, to meet a senior IDF or similar person, who gives information, whether it's on the Sixth Day War or the Yom Kippur War or other incidents or tunneling or rockets or all that goes on around such like subjects. But actually, the first week is full of teaching as well as concentrated prayer times. The prayer times were such an eye-opener to me, because a prayer is scriptural with a short sentence usually, or two sentences maybe, but that's all you're allowed. And people come to a microphone, they pray, the next person's at a microphone, they pray. It's just like firing bullets at the enemy. Obviously there's other prayer too, but it was so concentrated, no waffle at all. If there was anyone who waffled, there would be a kindly reminder that we don't waffle. And going back to the Galilee worship that I was at just weeks ago, I benefited because the whole group was, they don't all know each other, but there was no leadership, but such unity, such openness. And if I say to you, I felt really well ordered, and the whole atmosphere was likened at times to being in the upper room waiting for the Holy Spirit to come. And he came in power. Yes. And it was the time which somebody else said to me, it just blew me away. And I think I'm still saying that. I'm still processing it quite considerably. Mm. It's been a marvel. It's going to go on being a marvel.
Brilliant. That's just the sort of testimony you want to hear. Thanks. Anybody else got anything to share along these lines? You all want to go now, don't you? Pray we start travelling again, because I'm sure God is opening things up like that. So,
So can I just add that I don't think we'd all be sitting here together if it hadn't been for an Israel tour that Steve and I went on, which started the whole of the foundations conferences. Yeah. We'd inherited some money and decided, yeah, this is the time to go. So we went on a Chris Hill tour. And at the time, Steve had written some books already. And we had sort of felt that there were so many people around the country that needed to be networked together, somehow to connect people together. And it was, we were sort of birthing the idea of how could we get people together and thinking about a conference. And when we met one of the managers of Quinta, who was on the tour at the same time with his wife. And he said, well, Quinta have been thinking about running conferences now. We don't normally do that. And that was our first Quinta conference.
Yeah.
Foundations. So if you trace it through, it was our tour with Chris and Lindy.
Yeah.
Birthed all the foundations conferences and really led to what we're doing today, meeting together.
Yeah.
You know? That's amazing.
Thanks for that. Yes, and now of course Steve pops over regularly to write his books and.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd mentioned briefly about my three trips, which at least 20 years ago now, maybe 25, and I didn't mean to disparage them because even though the first trip was just going around the sites, the second one was a study tour, where the main guide was a spirit-filled Messianic Jew. And boy, what did I learn that on that trip? I just couldn't get enough of it. And that was, for me, was the beginning of the whole journey into Jewish background, Hebraic roots, developing my Bible teaching in that sort of way, and eventually linking me up with other people. And of course, that was reinforced through Chris Hill's study tour. And it was only because once you've been to the same places three times in about 3 years, you feel that's probably enough for a while, that I stopped. But I'm raring to go again. But again, that deepened me as a teacher and just as a Bible reader to go and to study the scriptures in that sort of place and to have it explained by people out there, as well as people like Chris going and taking groups. So study tours, prayer tours, worship now, obviously, very significant. That's where you go. It's not just on a touristy visit. It's because God wants to impact you in the land. Anybody else want to share anything on...
I think for me, I went out, was it 2015 again? Because I had, that was the third time I'd been out, but the first time was 5 weeks, the second time was 9 months, and the third time was like 4 weeks. And for me, I did some studying for two of the weeks, but then I had 2 weeks of my own in Israel. And I just loved that, you know, because I was able to sit at the Western Wall. And I saw, obviously, I'm in the ladies' section, so I saw this lady come up. She had a pram, she had a toddler, and she had another young person. And they just sat and they rocked and they read scriptures.
Yeah.
They just sat there and did that in Hebrew. And obviously, I could recognize some words. And I just sat there. I probably sat there for about 3 or 4 hours because I was in the shade. And then I went to the upper room. For me, in the upper room was, again, groups were passing through. But I was sitting there and there was a whole load of Brazilians. And if you know Brazilians, they're pretty charismatic, especially when they worship. And, you know, there had been a German group, a French group, and now there was these Brazilians worshiping God in, was it Portuguese or Spanish or whatever? But they were really giving their heart over to God. And then there was others also. And I was literally sitting there weeping. Because I just felt, God, is this what it's like in heaven? The nations worship you, Spirit and truth. And, you know, there are so many things like that, that if you're not sort of shunted around on a tour, if you can actually just sit and be, or you can just experience and take time to do that, God always impacts. I truly believe it.
Yeah, that's the point that's just come to me. All the tours I've been on, it was right now on the bus again, off we go to the next thing, even if it's a good study tour. And what everyone else is describing is you need time, you need to go at God's pace and just wait for him, and then you come away changed. So this is inspiring me, I must say.
You need a foundations in Israel, Steve. Where are you?
Well, he's left the room at the moment, but Monica will pass that on to him.
We need a foundations in Israel.
Foundations, Jerusalem, yes, I know. Okay.
Busy tour.
Not just 4 days.
Yeah, okay. Oh, we'll work on it.
But, I was going to suggest the same thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Got to be worth the effort.
Seeds have been sown. Okay, we can think about that. Jolly good. Anybody else want to contribute on this section? We're not obviously going to do the third thing, but in the last 5 minutes, I'll explain what it is because we'll do it next time. But anyone else want to chip in for now?
Steve's,
on again. Yeah.
going on. No, just I went along with Chris and Lindy on one of their tours, and I think for me, one of the things, apart from Chris's teaching, of course, was more an awareness of the geography of Israel, space, and it taught me to stop when I was reading.
Yeah.
Because having more of an awareness of where things were, you read passages in the scripture, and it sort of flows on as though they're together.
Yes, indeed.
Jesus went down from Jerusalem to Capernaum, where he said, and unless you sort of realise, but you sort of think, well, hang on, he was speaking in Jerusalem, then it records what he said in Capernaum.
Yeah.
But we sort of lost a week here somewhere. What did you say during the week?
It sets everything in a totally different context. And I agree, when I was on Chris's tour, it was reading the right bits in the right place and connecting it together like that was brilliant. So, okay. Steve, the result of this evening is that we're going to have to do a Foundations Jerusalem.
They want one down there.
I know, it's even more so now. For Foundations Israel. Anyway, we're about to finish for today. Next time, two things I'm going to do, one of which I was going to do tonight, but I'm glad I've had a chance to leave that because I wasn't as fully prepared as I might be. So half of it will be looking at Palm Sunday. We're going to read some scriptures or look at the actual events of Palm Sunday. And that's sort of, why did that happen like that? And why then? And the other things I had lined up, which I'll leave with you in a sort of question form, because I've been trying to get my head around what it really means to be thought of or called a Zionist. Now that Chris has been to Mount Zion, she's a Zionist, isn't she? But what does it mean to be a Christian Zionist? Do you consider yourself to be a Christian Zionist? If so, what does that mean for you? Is there a definition of it? And if you're not thought of it like that and someone comes up and says, oh, you're one of those Christian Zionists or one of those Zionists, would you be offended or feel accused? Would you feel that you're in a minority? So I'm trying to explore that idea. And in particular, because there was this book called The New Christian Zionism, which I found very helpful. So I wanted to know, well, if this is the new Christian Zionism, what's the old one? And so I've been putting together some thoughts and notes on that. So we'll discuss that, and I'm just giving you a bit of a taster on that to think for yourself. What does this phrase mean to you? Do you think it's one that applies to you, or you would like to apply to you? Are you afraid of it? Would it make you a bit of an obsessionist or someone in a minority if you go around saying, well, I'm a Zionist? What's the biblical basis for it? And things like that. So those are the two topics left for next time. Okay?
Is that next week?
Yes, it is next week. One more I'm doing next week. Then Steve's doing his Easter telling. And then we're heading up towards the conference. But given the circumstances now, and with me trying to get more into Zoom, I'm going to be doing this a lot more. So I will be back in Foundations Bible School sometime in the summer, and I'll have another set of maybe a bit of a series lined up to do with you. So it's not going to stop.
Brilliant.
Right.
Okay, I'll stop the recording.
Yeah, stop the recording. Thank you. And feel free to chat or leave the meeting.